I would imagine that by this time in the program, you're all getting pretty sleepy. So I really admire your fortitude in being here early in the morning for this talk. And I hope you'll get something out of it to have a payoff for your efforts and your faithfulness. The topic, I believe, that's listed for this talk is how war promotes the growth of big government. And what I've put up here is a little different, but in substance, the same thing. Because in my view, the growth of government is one side of a coin. The other side is the loss of our liberties. So this is what I'm still using. And what I want to do is, first of all, let you know that what I'm going to say here is not much of an intellectual innovation on my part, at least in its basic outlines. The relation between war and the loss of liberty is something that's been appreciated for a long, long time by many people. Many of you I know are libertarians, and as such, you've no doubt come across the saying, it's a virtual mantra for most libertarians, that war is the health of the state, which was a statement made by Randolph Bourne in 1918 in a manuscript he was writing and never completed because, unfortunately, he died very early and did not complete the work he was writing at the time. But what he did complete of it is titled War is the Health of the State. And if you simply search for it on the web, you'll find it very quickly. And I highly recommend that you read Randolph Bourne's essay. It's splendid. It's very topical, even today, as much as it was during the madness of 1918. Long before Bourne, however, other people had realize that war is a devastating occasion for liberty. And I'd like to just give you a few examples, particularly a couple of statements made by James Madison, often called the father of the Constitution. And Madison was a very thoughtful political philosopher and probably would have been better off if he had stuck to political philosophy and not got involved in being president. But at all events, he wrote in a letter in 1795 the following: "Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies, debts, and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare." Let me read that last sentence again. "No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare." Now let me remind you that the United States has been at war virtually continually since 1939. My entire lifetime, and as you can see, I'm not a young person, the United States has been at war. Sometimes many wars at once. No nation can preserve its liberty in the midst of continual warfare. And one of the reasons this nation has not preserved its people's liberties is because it has engaged in continual warfare. Madison wrote a few years later in 1798 in a letter, "Perhaps it is a universal truth that the loss of liberty at home is to be charged against provisions against danger, real or pretended, from abroad." We should know all about that relationship now, because 9/11, a criminal event, has been leveraged into the excuse and the apology for an enormous intrusion on our liberties and a gigantic explosion of government power. All of this on the pretext of a war against a tactic, terror. Bruce Porter is a political scientist who published a book in 1994 called War and the Rise of the State. I recommend this book. Porter surveyed about five centuries of Western history. So this is not a book simply about the United States, but about all the Western European countries as well, and some of the European offshoots overseas, including the United States. And after this enormous survey, Porter concluded the following. A government at war is a juggernaut of centralization, determined to crush any internal opposition that impedes the mobilization of militarily vital resources. This centralizing tendency of war has made the rise of the state throughout much of history a disaster for human liberty and rights. I'm in complete agreement with these statements I've read you, and much of my research over the past 30 years or more has been devoted to identifying aspects of the relationship between war and the loss of liberty, economic, civil, and other liberties, and to trying to understand better the logic, the mechanics, the politics of why this relationship exists. And what I want to do now is walk you through the logic of this relationship. Why is it the case that war is a disaster for liberty? Even in nations where a large degree of liberty has been established. Why does war eat into that liberty? What goes on that makes it do so? We're all told, almost ceaselessly, that government's wars are for the purpose of protecting us, protecting our liberties, saving us from tyrants, despots, and dictators, terrorists, and bad guys. We're told that, but it never works out that way. When these alleged protective efforts have been carried out, the end result is we have fewer liberties than we had before they were carried out. Because we're always asked to make a trade-off, to surrender certain liberties in exchange for protections, for greater security, more safety. We're asked to make a trade-off, but the trade-off never happens. It's always false. We pay the price, but we don't get the goods. In other words, we've been fooled again, time and time again. The logic I'm going to lay out for you is one that applies especially during a major war, when large amounts of resources must be transferred from their existing uses to military uses. It won't apply so much, or it won't apply in every regard, if we're dealing with a minor war, a war that is, so to speak, fought out of military inventory. If the United States decides to go to war against Serbia, as it did in the late 90s, for example, that hardly triggers the process I'm going to describe for you, largely because that process has already taken place in the past and put the government in a position where it can wage these small wars without doing anything special except dropping the bombs on Serbia instead of on a firing range. But in every major war, we'll have certain necessities that the government faces. A major war requires the government to transfer a lot of resources from civilian hands to the government's hands. And the question then becomes, how is it going to get these resources for war? Well, one way, not often discussed, is the government could simply ask for people to pony up the resources. Could explain to them, we're in danger, so much danger that we must go to war. And I'm sure you'll understand, fellow citizens, the imperative need for you to donate to the cause. And indeed, it does acquire some resources in this way. For example, early in wars, the government often asked for men to come forward and enlist in the armed forces. That is to donate their services to stop using their labor services in civilian employments and to bring them forth for use as soldiers. And some people always come forth, but never as many as the government considers necessary. And besides the soldiers' labor, very few resources are ever donated to the cause. People don't simply run to their banks and withdraw their money and hand it over to the government to wage war. And this tells us something right away. I don't know that many people ever dwell on this, but the fact that this so-called public or collective good, war making for defensive purposes, it's always defensive, of course, war making is a public good, and people could contribute to it. And of course, our public choice theorists rush onto the scene to tell us, no, they won't, because everyone will try to free ride. It's a public good. Well, if we think about that for a minute, we see that that can't be a very good explanation for what's going on here, because other public goods, like, say, the services of churches, of priests and rabbis, and other dispensers of religious lore and wisdom, by the thousands, somehow managed to attract voluntary support. Why is it that some kinds of public goods can get enough resources to conduct their business and others can't? Well, I would suggest to you it's because what we've got here is a public good that is not really valued as much as the government claims it is valuable. That, in fact, we've got a conflict here, that the state wants to use resources for one purpose, and the people who possess those resources prefer to use them for some other purpose. And it's the resolution of this conflict that the government faces as its basic problem here. So donations won't feed the baby, and something else has to be done. Now, the usual way the government gets resources transferred to itself is by taxing people and using the tax revenues then to purchase the goods and services it wants. And in wartime, that is also the case. So wars invariably, large wars, invariably involve raising tax rates and imposing new kinds of taxes. Now, that is somewhat successful in every case. That is, the government does manage to greatly increase its revenues in wartime. However, once again, as in the case of donations, we see that there's a negative aspect of this. For every government positive action here, there's an opposite public reaction. A kind of political science physics is going on. Newton's law of extracting resources from people. Whenever you try to extract them, they resist in some way. They try to avoid the taxes or even evade the taxes. They may rearrange their affairs to be less liable to taxation. That's tax avoidance. Or they may simply disobey the law that requires them to pay the taxes. That's tax evasion. So we've got, when government increases taxes for war, an increase in tax avoidance and tax evasion. And so the government doesn't solve the problem as fully as it hoped to by raising tax revenues. It still needs more resources in order to carry out a major war. Well, it normally gets the rest by borrowing. It will try to sell its bonds to investors, but in a major war, when the government offers a large quantity of bonds, the price of bonds falls, the effective yield, that is the interest rate on these bonds, rises. That means the financing cost for the government's war making goes up, and that's a problem too. Because it's already got a problem of not being able to finance the war it wants to make. So now it's even more difficulty because the financing costs have risen. So it tries to deal with that by bringing a central bank, if it has one, into play. Normally, the central bank will create credit through the usual channels of commercial lending, and the Fed will make that kind of lending more feasible by flooding the banking system with reserves by the usual monetary actions. So the Fed can be called to accommodate the government's borrowing, and in both world wars, for example, it was used in that way to a great extent. So this is a kind of hidden way of creating money indirectly through the banking system rather than simply printing it as the government did during the war between the states when the U.S. Treasury simply printed up $300 million worth of so-called greenbacks, just U.S. notes, fiat currency based on nothing, no backing, no convertibility into gold, no nothing except a legal tender law that said you have to accept this for all debts, public and private, except the payment of customs duties, which you still had to pay in gold during the war between the states. That's an interesting exception, don't you think? But at all events, that was an alternative way because there was no central bank at the time. But countries with a central bank will put it to use in helping them finance wars. Now, when interest rates are being driven up alternatively, besides getting the Fed to help out, the government may impose interest rate controls because it's harmful in the economy generally if interest rates rise greatly, and that puts a crimp on investment and causes other distortions. So very often, as during World War II, for example, the government will impose controls on various interest rates. And during World War II, again, the government not only put controls on interest rates, but it actually put limits on or prohibited certain forms of lending. Installment credit was prohibited during World War II, so that people who used to buy things and make payments instead of paying for consumer durable goods at the time they bought them, were not allowed to do those installment payments anymore. This was something called Regulation Q of the Federal Reserve, and it stayed around for quite a while after the war ended. So you can try to control capital markets, or you can try to plug gaps that the capital markets aren't filling. The government can make direct investments where private investors aren't putting their money where the government wants them to promote the war. All of these things happened in American history and other histories as well. The government takes its revenues, whether obtained by borrowing or taxation, and it goes out and tries to buy the things it wants for war. And when it does that, it tends to bid up prices. And the prices it's for the goods it's buying directly, these increases tend to spill over because some goods are inputs in the creation of other goods and so forth. And so there's a tendency for the general price level to rise when the government is undertaking a large-scale war. And so again, the government has to deal with that reaction. And it does this in a number of ways, rigging markets with price controls, setting priorities for the use of raw materials, directly allocating specific materials so that they cannot be used by certain users until high-priority users have been fully satisfied, and so forth. The most complete version of this kind of planning apparatus was created during World War II in a very full-fledged form, not exactly like the Soviet central planning, but with many similarities, especially in physical allocations of resources. But when this is done, of course, as with any kind of government commands that fly in the face of what people prefer to do, there are compliance problems. And so those have to be dealt with in order for the program to go forward. And finally, an alternative or a third way of getting control of resources is simply to seize them. Just take them. Government can go out and condemn land, for example, and take it from the private owner and build a shipyard or an army base there instead of letting this present owner keep it in its present use. That was done a great deal during both world wars, for example. And the most important form of seizure of all is conscription of labor, drafting of soldiers. And the national government has been drafting soldiers since the war between the states. And in World War I, it perfected the system by creating the arrangement of local draft boards that would be located all over the country in every city and county to give the draftees the impression that they were being drafted by their friends and neighbors rather than by the national government thousands of miles away somewhere, people who didn't know anything about them. And strange to say, that system worked beautifully by comparison with the poor performance of the Civil War draft, which often required armed troops to go out and drag the men out of their homes and force them into the army. Only about 6% of the people in the Northern armies were drafted because the North was rich enough to be able to pay large bounties to attract soldiers. But in the Confederacy, with less wealth at their disposal, the Confederate leaders had to draft far more people to staff the army, and the estimates are that somewhere between 25 and 30% of the Confederate soldiers were drafted, often in sort of impromptu ways, on the spot, as it were, by local military authorities. So this is a final way, and normally governments in a major war use all of these devices at once. They are continually changing the way they use them, altering the rules, shuffling around how much effort they put into different kinds of resource acquisition. Now, as I've said, whenever it attempts to take control of resources currently in private hands, the government faces resistance. And not only will it face resistance of a kind of individual sort, such as tax avoidance and tax evasion, but it will often face organized or semi-organized resistance as groups come forward to complain about what's happening, even to complain about the fact that the government has gone to war. There's always a certain amount of anti-war sentiment in the public, although sometimes it can be driven almost totally underground, as it was during World War II. But in other wars, it was quite visible, and the government has to deal with that, because if war resistors or other opponents of the government's war measures are allowed to simply go about their business, politicking and exhorting people to join them, then there may be so much resistance that the whole program is unable to go forward. There may be so much resistance that the government itself is overthrown. Indeed, that has happened in other countries, although it never happened that way in the United States. But in order to meet this resistance, the government resorts to various measures of suppression. And this is the point at which especially civil liberties begin to take a serious beating during wartime, because the ways in which people are resisting are ordinarily perfectly legitimate ways of voicing their grievances. But during wartime, the government will not tolerate even these legitimate means of expressing opposition, so that there have been draconian restrictions on the rights that we think are protected under the First Amendment, rights of free speech, rights of assembly, of petition for redress of grievances, and rights of free press. All these things have been suppressed to a greater or lesser degree during major wars by the national government. In some cases, the suppressions have been extraordinary, almost unbelievable. During World War I, which was probably the worst for sheer madness, the people were arrested and jailed for such crimes as publicly reading the Constitution of the United States. This happened on several occasions. And at the same time, people who only privately uttered some words of disagreement with the war program were lynched, killed by mobs. And this happened a number of times during 1917 and 18 in the United States. And people of German descent took the worst beating in this regard. But when people's liberties are being overridden in this way, it's invariably the case that groups that are already unpopular will be brought into the fray. So that, for example, in World War I, a lot of foreigners who were living in the United States, not violating any law by living here, but living here and espousing unpopular political views, such as anarchism or communism, but not committing any crime, simply espousing their views, were rounded up and without any due process whatsoever, deported, most of them deported to Russia. Where some of them had not lived before or had not lived for decades, and it was like being dumped in a foreign country for them. But at all events, they were rounded up and deported merely for speaking unpopular ideas. And labor organizations such as the International Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, so-called Wobblies, were attacked mercilessly in many parts of the United States and murdered. A number of incidents happened in the area I used to live in the northwest of the United States, where the Wobblies were well established at the time. But at all events, the government will attempt to restrict First Amendment rights during wartime. At the same time that it's taking that kind of hostile measures, it will attempt to soothe people and to bring them along and to make them believers in what it's doing with masses of propaganda. So it's working from both sides. It's trying to make friends with as many people as it can so they'll go along with the war, and at the same time it's trying to crush those who won't go along. So it's working in two different ways there at the same time. And this propaganda often takes forms that people are unaware of, such as in World War II, the government worked very actively with filmmakers in Hollywood to make sure that the films portrayed the right kind of pro-war, pro-American messages. It more or less intimidated the radio broadcasters to see that they never said an unpatriotic word on the air. It censored hundreds of newspapers in World War One, the government had simply refused to distribute many newspapers through the mail as they were normally distributed, so they were essentially shut down. And at the time of World War One, many newspapers in the United States, hundreds, perhaps thousands, were published in foreign languages because the country was full of recent immigrants in those days. And the government required that every foreign language article printed had to be censored, and they would just forbid publication of an issue of the newspaper if they didn't like what it said. Now, needless to say, when you have a massive effort like that, a lot of the people who are hired by the government to do the suppression are going to be nitwits who aren't really nice and delicate and subtle about how they go about their work. And in the First World War, for example, many of these people were morons. They were superheated patriotic morons, and yet they were doing their part, as it were, to promote the war. In World War I, for example, a group was formed by an advertising executive called the American Protective League. And at one point, they claimed to have 250,000 people working for them. And this was an astonishing outfit. They undertook in all sorts of ways to suppress opposition to the war. For example, they hired a lot of women who would simply be workers in factories, but they would keep their eyes and ears open and make reports to the Protective League about any subversive action or speech they heard there in the factory. Or these people would organize themselves and raid homes where they thought someone might be escaping from the draft and haul these people off and hand them over to police on the grounds that they were avoiding the draft. Or they would simply browbeat people whose views they didn't like. They undertook a whole range of measures, and at the same time, they purported to be a junior G-men. They made up little badges for them to wear, which made them look like some kind of sheriffs. But in fact, they were not officially part of the government at all. They simply had the Attorney General's sanction. He kind of said he was pleased that they had come forward to assist the government in its hour of need. So this is the kind of organized vigilantism that the war inspired in World War I, especially. World War II saw less of that because there was less opposition, mainly. But at all events, this is the sort of thing that war brings to the fore. In addition, there's always an enlargement of the police apparatus. There's more surveillance. More people are arrested, prosecuted, and in some cases deported than normally. And in both world wars, for example, the FBI, or the Bureau of Investigation, as it was called during World War I, increased the number of agents tremendously, several fold, and so there's lots of spying going on domestically, lots of attempts to ferret out saboteurs and spies who are never numerous enough. You see, there are never enough of these real saboteurs and spies to go around, so they have to invent them the way the FBI now invents these terrorists, by going out and finding dim-witted people that it can make suggestions to and promise to supply with weapons and explosives and what have you, and until it gets enough evidence on these people to prosecute them and then make a big public show of its having saved us from the horrors of terrorism. If there's one thing government is always and everywhere, it's a fraud. It's a business for liars and deceivers everywhere it exists. And this aspect of the government comes to the fore in wartime much more than in peacetime. And of course, there's an encouragement of informants in wartime much more than usual, just as there is now. See something? Say something. Unfortunately, this is again an appeal to dim-witted people. You know? They see a Sikh walking down the street with a turban on, and so they say something about this terrorist. Right? You're never going to lose money by underestimating the intelligence of the average man. Right? And normally, that's okay. We can live with that. But in wartime, it's a real danger. It's a real danger when the average man starts to help out. Now, at the same time that the government during wartime wants to know everything about people, what they're doing, what they're saying, it wants the people to know nothing about the government, what it's doing, what it's planning, how it's going about its business. And we see that with a vengeance today, even though today's war is a phony war. It's a wholly concocted war. It's a non-war, called a war on terror. Okay? And what we see now is these massive measures of surveillance in which they read every email if they want to. They listen to every phone call if they want to. Everybody, every man, woman, and child, all the garbage we're communicating to one another, they're storing in Utah so that they can delve into it with their algorithms and dredge up something to use against somebody when they feel like it. This is the kind of transparency they want us to have to them. At the same time, they are classifying more government documents than ever before in history. And so if we want to know what they're doing, we're just out of luck because that's classified. Make it asymmetric. Okay, well, we're always told that many of these actions the government takes in wartime are unfortunate, but what we have to do is realize that these are only temporary measures. We have to accept them for the time being, for the duration, as they used to say when wars ended. We accept them for the duration, and then when the war ends, these extraordinary measures will end. And we will have the same liberties we had before the war. Hooray! All will be well. This won't be forever, ladies and gentlemen. But that's never the case. Never, never, never is it the case that there are no legacies. There are always legacies of wars, and major wars in particular. And they take various forms. There's the fiscal forms, of course, the big run-up in government spending, taxing, and borrowing during the war never gets brought back to the same level as before the war. Big increase in government spending, war ends, government spending falls back, but not all the way to the pre-war level. And then it starts rollicking along its trend line again. Taxation. Big increases in taxes, new taxes created. Okay, government revenues go up after the war. Some reductions in tax rates, perhaps. Some kinds of taxes allowed to lapse, perhaps. Some small reduction in government revenues, but not anywhere near where they were before. A ratchet effect. Government has borrowed during the war. Does it pay off that debt after the war? Well, in the 19th century, yes, it would eventually pay off the borrowing of wartime. But in the 20th century, never. The debt just rises to a new level during every war and then goes on from there. So they're fiscal ratchets. Perhaps more important, they're institutional ratchets. During war, government passes new laws. It creates new organizations for war purposes or for enforcement purposes or for the suppression of liberties. And it sets precedents. Judges rule on cases. And even though those are wartime cases, emergency cases, those rulings become precedents for cases decided in non-emergency times subsequently. You may have noticed recently that Edward Snowden, the whistleblower the government is trying to lay hands on, is being charged with several crimes, and that two of the charges are charges under the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act was passed in 1917. It's been on the statute books ever since 1917. It's been amended sometime since then, but it's still there. It's essentially a wartime legacy, lying there waiting for federal prosecutors to use when they feel like it. And likewise for countless other laws, countless other court decisions, countless other organizations created specifically for war purposes, which are never eliminated, or sometimes are eliminated only by changing their mission a little bit, by changing their names, but by keeping the essential powers and apparatus. And then finally, I believe perhaps more important than even institutional and fiscal legacies are the ideological ratchets that have occurred, particularly during major wars such as the world wars. When people live with their liberties suppressed for years on end, when they live with government authorities who are exercising great powers over them, Of course, many won't like it, but even those who won't like it get used to it. They make the best of a bad situation. They try to get along by going along. Not many of us are revolutionaries. We're not just yearning to go to the barricades, die for the cause. Most people just do the best they can in the circumstances where they find themselves. But by doing that during these extraordinary periods, they are accommodating themselves to live under tyranny. And as a result, even when the wars end, the people's attitudes and outlooks are never the same as they were before, because they've been conditioned by these experiences of regimentation, of orders, of irrational suppression of liberties. And so when the government continues to do these things, they don't rise up and say, wait, you can't do that. Well, they know the government can. It's done it before, and they put up with it in wartime. And so some of them don't even notice as much the second time around or the third time around. This is just the new state of the world. As Vice President Cheney rushed to tell us almost immediately after 9/11, the endless war on terror was the new normal. The new normal. It would never end, he promised. And sure as hell, it shows no signs of ending now. It's continuing to be raised to higher and higher levels of outrageousness and expense and tyrannical behavior by the government. It's worse than the new normal. It's the new steadily worse normal. So the ideological ratchet is and has been in the past perhaps the most serious consequence of war making by the state. And so what we get here as a result of all these things working together is a upward ratcheting process of the growth of government, in which every national emergency, particularly war emergency, creates a ratchet, raises the growth of government to a higher level. The trajectory extends, again, emergency, higher level, and it raises to greater and greater government power, with greater government scope, greater government size, and fewer individual liberties as we go along. This mass of data, which I will test you on at the end of the hour, shows you... Breathe. I don't mean it. It shows you some of the fiscal accounts of the government during World War I. It makes a nice illustration. What you see in the first column over there is government receipts. Government tax revenues before World War I were considerably below $1 billion a year. And as you see, starting in fiscal year 1918, particularly, they leapt up 200%, and then they leapt up again in 1919 and 1920. And indeed, here, even though they come down a little bit in 1921 and then sort of level off from 1923 on, that new level, say the level from 1923 on, is, you know, between 3.5 and 4 billion, as opposed to 750 million before the war. And that's notwithstanding the famous Coolidge tax cuts of the 1920s. So we have a definite tax revenue ratchet here. Now, these are not adjusted for changes in the price level, but if you did that, you'd still have a large ratchet. These are in nominal dollars, but the price level was only about twice after the war what it had been before the war. Actually, after 1921, not even twice what it had been before the war. So there's a large receipts ratchet. The outlays, you see, were about the same as the receipts before the war. That is, the government had a balanced budget normally. And during the war, then there's a gigantic increase in government outlays from 750 million to to more than $18 billion in one fiscal year, 1918. And then when the war ends, those spending levels decline, but they end up leveling off in the neighborhood of $3 billion a year instead of $750 million a year. And again, if you adjust for price changes, that's still a large ratchet in government outlays. When you look at the surplus and deficit there in the next column, you see the great extent to which World War I was financed by borrowing. The great bulk of it was financed in that way. And so you see the consequences for debt. The federal debt was only a little over $1 billion before the war. And at the end of the war, it's more than $25 billion. So the increase in the government's debt was huge. And that was basically the transition when the United States went from a federal government that normally had a balanced budget, except during wartime itself, and at other times it either balanced the budget or had a surplus. It went from that into a period of carrying large federal debt forever. So we've just gone to higher and higher levels of government debt until during the past 50 years, an annual deficit is the normal state of the federal budget, so the federal debt is perpetually getting bigger all the time. But this was the landmark here in World War I when that transition occurred. I mentioned before how the Fed accommodated the government's sale of bonds during World War I, and you see that in the next to last column for money stock. In fact, what you see here is quite extraordinary, because if you compare 1915, a money stock of $17 billion, with 1920, money stock of more than $34 billion, and what you see is a almost exact doubling of the money stock in that five-year period. And now look at the price level over there, as measured by the GDP deflator. What you see between 1915 and 1920 is an exact doubling of the price level. So if you wanted a textbook example of the quantity theory of money, voila, there it is. Double the money stock, double the price level. Worked like a charm in that case. Of course, it doesn't always work like a charm, because the demand for money doesn't necessarily always stay the same and allow this kind of relationship to result, but in World War I it did. So we end up with much higher prices after the war than we had before the war. When you look at how the Fed accommodated the government's actions during World War II, you see here the Fed's balance sheet telling you the story. You've got the Fed's gold holding down there in yellow. And when the Fed was created, it was expected to hold a large gold reserve for its liabilities. And it did. But when the war came, the Federal Reserve Act began to be amended quite rapidly. And one of the important changes that was made was the change in what the Fed would require as collateral when it made a loan to a commercial bank. When the Fed was created, the law required that loans be secured with collateral of commercial paper, that is, with short-term notes owed to the bankers by their customers, usually payable in 90 days or less. And this was viewed as very low-risk kind of collateral. And so if the banks wanted to borrow to get temporary liquidity from the Federal Reserve Bank, they would have to pony up the collateral that would allow the Fed to make that loan. But during the war, the law was changed so that banks could offer U.S. government bonds as collateral. And when it did that, it created a kind of perpetual motion machine. Because if the banks would buy U.S. bonds, which they did in massive amounts during the war, then they could turn around and use those bonds as collateral to borrow at low interest rates from the Fed, and then turn around and buy U.S. bonds or loan money to customers who bought U.S. bonds And so, in a way, the Fed was making possible the continual rise in the holdings of U.S. government bonds through the way it made its discounts and advances. That's the purple area in the chart. And so what you see is that that was the source of all the increase in the Fed's balance sheet during the war, was that it was making credit available to commercial banks. It wasn't buying new issues of U.S. government bonds directly, because you know we regard that sort of thing as primitive and excessively transparent in our country, and we like to make things a little more difficult for the public to understand. And believe me, the public is clueless about the workings of the Fed, even today. And the Fed is much more discussed today than it ever was up until a few years ago. It's never been a topic of polite conversation until very recently, thanks to Ron Paul, for the most part, who made it a topic. But nonetheless, during World War I, the Fed flooded the country with credit through the commercial banking system, and the banks and their customers then purchased the government's bonds without the interest rate being driven sky high and putting a brake on the government's borrowing and then use of the revenues for war purposes. So this is the story. Now, you see, after the war ends, the government begins to rectify the wartime distortion of its balance sheet. It begins to reduce these discounts and advances. It also created, as Murray Rothbard discusses in some of his writing, this market for bankers' acceptances, which was a kind of scheme to have the Fed compete with the Bank of England in a sort of security that had never been used to much extent in the United States, but became a standard financial security afterwards, thanks to the Fed's sponsoring it, fomenting it. So the Fed did squeeze back, particularly in 1921, and that was the major reason for the short but sharp depression of late 1921 in this country. So this is one of the many legacies of the war, was this business contraction. And unfortunately, when that contraction occurred, although there was a large deflation that accompanied it, it was not a deflation large enough to bring the purchasing power of the dollar anywhere near its pre-war purchasing power. And then the Fed stabilized and began to institute new policies in the 1920s, which I'm sure you've heard already from other speakers here, helped to create the preconditions for the bust of 1929 that brought on the catastrophe of the Great Depression. So many of the events we see in the 20s and 30s that tend to be analyzed as freestanding. You know, it's, for example, when Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz talk about the Fed and the Great Depression, they kind of have forgotten about World War I by that time. And they're just looking at what the Fed does almost from month to month in 1928 or 29 and saying, okay, this has an effect. But what we're seeing here throughout the 20s and even into the 30s are many echoes, many legacies of the actions the government took during World War I. This war did not just occur, have effects, end, and we went back to normal. Just as I mentioned the Espionage Act a few minutes ago, whose amendment in 1918 is known as the Sedition Act, the most draconian suppression of liberties in all of American history. If you don't know about the Sedition Act, Google it. Look it up. And what you'll find is that this was a law in which the government criminalized every form imaginable of even speaking ill about the government, about the Congress, the President, the armed forces, the flag, the uniform of the armed forces, you name it. You could be prosecuted and imprisoned for saying a foul word about any of these aspects of the state. It never got any worse than that. And many people were imprisoned, not only by federal federal prosecution, but the states all followed suit and had state sedition acts under which even more people were punished. So it was a period of, I really think, madness in which the American people, who have always had some affection for liberty, forgot everything they knew about liberty and flew into a madness of punishing everybody who did not go along with what was itself the real madness, the Wilson administration's injection of the United States into the Great War. Thanks a lot.